Welcome to the America's Quarterly Podcast. I'm Brian Winter. What would a future Biden administration's policies towards Latin America look like? It won't be as simple as just turning the clock back to 2015. Too much has changed.
Even among Democrats, if Joe Biden wins, we're all going to have a default to kind of going to the way things are before the Trump administration. But the world is not that world anymore. We need to actually be thinking about long-term interests of this hemisphere.
During the Barack Obama administration, Joe Biden was his unofficial envoy to Latin America and the Caribbean, spending a lot of time working on issues like Central America and migration. And he was pretty good at it for reasons that are, frankly, kind of hard to define. In 2013, Joe Biden visited Brasilia with the difficult task of making friends and winning the trust of Dilma Rousseff, who was then Brazil's president. And let me tell you, as somebody who covered Dilma Rousseff for 5 years as a reporter based in Brazil, this wasn't easy. But Joe Biden somehow managed it. I think two things worked in his favor. One of them, kind of the obvious one that everybody talks about with Biden, was charm. So, okay, that's pretty predictable. But the second thing, and I reported on this at the time, was credibility. Dilma Rousseff believed him and thought that when he made promises about what the Senate would do in regard to Brazil, thought she could take him at his word. And, you know, there's just something about Joe that works in Latin America. So if he wins this election in November and takes office in January 2021, the challenges will be enormous. It's a hemisphere, Western hemisphere, that has really struggled more than any other region in the world so far with COVID-19, not only with the health implications, but also with the economic destruction. But it's a complex picture because the truth is, you know, there are a lot of governments in Latin America that kind of like Donald Trump to varying degrees. The Iván Duque administration in Colombia, to name one. And even Andrés Manuel López Obrador in Mexico, as evidenced by his recent visit to Washington. And that's without even talking about the man who's now president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, who sees him as kind of a fellow traveler. So trying to figure out what a Biden presidency might look like in Latin America, it's a complex picture. We've got a great guy to help us through some of this. I'm joined from Washington, D.C. by Juan Gonzalez. Juan is a principal at JSG Strategy and the former special advisor to Vice President Joe Biden on Latin America. Just a programming note, Juan is here today speaking in a personal capacity and not on behalf of any campaign. Juan, thanks for joining us.
Brian, thanks for having me. And your introduction brought back many conversations I had with you when you were a correspondent and I was at the White House trying to figure out what was going on in Brazil.
You were my secret source.
No comment.
Yeah, right. So tell me, what do you think would be the biggest difference in terms of policy towards Latin America under a Biden administration?
That is a great question. So look, I mean, the first thing I would say in terms of leaders that seem to have a good relationship with Donald Trump, I think that is more of a relationship of necessity as opposed to choice, where even the visit of López Obrador, I would regard as an exercise in pandering to a mercurial U.S. president who is capable of anything, including undermining U.S. interests to prove a point. Colombia, I would say the same, that with a president that doesn't understand the history of the U.S.-Colombia relationship and is willing to say that Colombia has done nothing for the United States, you got to handle people like that a certain way. I think the contrast here that Joe Biden provides is twofold. First of all, you know, the man is, as vice president, made, I think it was 16 visits to the region. I traveled with him nine times to the region. Is somebody who has a deep reservoir of expertise. He has an existing record on every region of the Americas. And frankly, he cares about these sorts of issues. That's the first one. And the second one is, he's a man of his word, and he means when he says that the United States should be supporting a vision for the region that is secure, middle class, and democratic. Whereas Donald Trump focuses on U.S. security as a matter of building a wall. Somebody like Joe Biden, you know, developed the Central America strategy because he saw that investing in the security and prosperity of the country actually provided benefits for the security and prosperity of the United States. That in the Caribbean, when Venezuelan oil diplomacy was starting to recede, he saw an opportunity that instead of going to the Caribbean countries, you know, once a year for votes at the United Nations, he thought that by providing a viable alternative to Petrocaribe, you could start winning over the countries of the Caribbean by actually trying to respond to their national interests. And then we could talk more about Brazil. But with Brazil, you know, it's also this calculation driven by kind of U.S. interest, where he saw that Rousseff herself did not figure into the calculus as much as the reality that, number one, that we needed to work with Brazil to address global challenges. But number two, that at a time where politically and economically her administration was suffering, the United States could move with Brazil in a new direction by trying to be responsive to those interests.
So I want to go through some of these issues point by point, recognizing that we're still here, you know, in July 2020. It's more than 3 months still till the election. A new administration would not take office for another 5-6 months. And we don't know who the policymakers on Latin America would be in a future Biden administration. But, you know, that said, on Venezuela, which I have to confess, I mean, I find so hard to kind of treat in any sort of hopeful manner right now, given how close things seem to have gotten in terms of a regime change in 2019. That now seems much less probable than it did. Maybe it was never that close, but at least it seemed closer than things had been for a long time. How would a Biden administration push differently on that topic?
It's a great question. I think it's worth also taking a step back here. You know, if you're somebody from the region or you're a Latin American expert and you're looking at the campaign and the sparring over Venezuela and Cuba, you would think that's all the United States cares about. And it's a bit of a caricature of the different approaches that the two candidates really have for the region. And so in that regard, and this gets to the Venezuela point, Donald Trump and every policy that this administration is advancing is skewed toward keeping Donald Trump in office, no matter what. And the electoral policy, I would divide into two parts. As it relates to the Latino community, you have his policy, I would say, west of the Mississippi, which is a demonization of immigrants from Latin America, a, you know, a kind of dog whistle to white supremacy that has been brought back into the mainstream of political discourse in this country by Donald Trump, and a kind of policy of scaring Americans into thinking that migrants are coming and invading the country. And you know, they're systematically taking apart the legal immigration system and the asylum system, of which right now the largest petitioners are Venezuelans. So that's west of the Mississippi. East of the Mississippi, and specifically in South Florida, is where you see the policy of this administration for the entire region has to be viewed through the prism of South Florida politics.
So what does that mean in practice?
In practice, what that means is you've seen an administration that has been very tough. Trump has been kind of dangling, whenever he goes to South Florida, this all options are on the table scenario that suggests that they're going to invade militarily, even though that is not something that this administration is going to do. The messaging machine that the Republicans have in South Florida is very effective at pushing that out. They roll out, you know, this maximum pressure strategy. They roll out sanctions with a lot of fanfare, and it appeals to this kind of immediate satisfaction of trying to punish the other. But in reality, there's no real calculus for outcomes in that policy or of supporting the democratic aspirations of the Venezuelan people. The contrast here with Joe Biden is that he is somebody who is not afraid of sanctions. But let me qualify that. When I was working with him and Senator Menendez passed the 2014 Venezuela Human Rights Act, the vice president committed to him that they would be enforced and would have teeth. And he actually went above and beyond the requirements of legislation to include tools that Treasury has used to sanction individuals. It's actually the same tools that this administration has used to sanction over 70-something individuals. But at the same time, like, sanctions are not a strategy. They're a tool in a broader strategy that require allies. Unilateral sanctions are ineffective. That's been proven. You have to actually have a much broader sanction regime that is designed, as Patrick Gaspard said in an op-ed recently, with a scalpel, as opposed to a mallet. That's the first thing. But sanctions don't work if you don't actually have a consistent approach, whereas this administration has gone from rejecting negotiations to supporting negotiations to wanting Maduro out. They're all over the place. What a Biden administration, I think, would view engagement really as a subversive act in places like Venezuela and Cuba, where if Maduro shows that he can actually take steps to support a democratic future, it opens up a whole other set of options, carrots and sticks, to continue to encourage that direction. If Maduro continues down the path that he's on, then what Joe Biden administration would do would be to further increase the pressure, but in a smart way and in cooperation with partners and in conversations with the Venezuelan opposition. Not only has he said that he would provide temporary protected status on day one, he has said that he would go after every penny that has been stolen from Venezuela, that he would organize the international community to support for a democratic outcome. And then, informed by his experience with playing Colombia, the day that Venezuelans get their country back, that the United States should be the first country in line to help them rebuild their country better.
One more question on Venezuela. I mean, have we gotten to the point where the United States just cannot really influence outcomes on the ground in Venezuela?
You're getting to one of the main problems with U.S. policy toward the region after the Cold War, in the sense that our policies in Latin America have traditionally been focused on trying to shape political developments inside of countries that are sometimes outside of our control. You know, a critic of that would say, well, that means you don't believe in supporting democracy. No, what that means is that U.S. policy should be driven by national interest, and it should be focused on promoting democratic outcomes in the aggregate and supporting democratic forces inside of these countries. The current trajectory that we are taking, we're going to be having the same conversation on Venezuela 50 years from now, much like we have had on Cuba, because, again, what informs the Republican views on this is South Florida and make sure that they're maintaining an electoral base, as opposed to really thinking strategically about what U.S. interests lie. And we can't really talk about Venezuela without talking about Cuba, where you've seen ECUS is a polling firm that's run by two Obama alum, Stephanie Valencia and Carlos Odio. They released a report on their studies recently where they said, look, there's been this disappointment with the Cuban-American community with the Obama policy changes because they did not secure an outcome. But that is, I think, a function of two things. I think number one is they weren't given enough time. And number two, the Trump maximum pressure strategy has been something that has been responsive to some of the frustrations and angers that the Cuban-American and the Venezuelan-American community feel toward these countries. The reality, however, is that the Obama policies, and today we're in a different world, right? It's several years since that policy was rolled out. The situation on the ground has changed. But at the core, what that policy did was it threatened the hardliners to maintain the status quo, both in South Florida and in Cuba, right? I don't think the Cuban Americans expected the United States to actually want to have a direct conversation and to actually seek to normalize relations in a way that would empower Cubans. And it wasn't done just because, it was done with the motive to support democratic forces in these countries. It was something we were doing to the Cuban regime, not for the Cuban regime.
And the Cubans missed the boat, meaning they did not step in and make the reforms that could have kept things moving in a constructive track. And maybe it's because they miscalculated politically and they thought that, you know, Hillary Clinton was going to win in 2016 and they'd have a chance, or maybe they just had no interest in doing so from the very beginning, right? And the idea that they were going to somehow bend was an illusion to begin with.
I think you're exactly right. And again, I don't speak for the vice president's view. I can share my perspective is that you're exactly right. I think maybe the Cubans have a longer sense of history and maybe, you know, think that these are a much longer trajectory, but we missed the political moment. And I think today, if a Biden administration would win, given the weight on this man's shoulders, right, he is going to literally have to inherit an economy in dire straits, a country that is completely disunited, a world that is in disarray. And his focus is going to be on getting the U.S. economy back on track and seeking common cause with those allies that are going to tackle these very urgent challenges before us on matters of climate change, the threat to democracies around the world, getting back from the pandemic. I don't see a first-term Biden administration investing a ridiculous amount of political capital and time, which are the two precious commodities that a president has, to wait for the Cubans to actually live up to their end of the deal. And he did say that recently in a TV interview. The ball's in their court in many ways. But on Venezuela, I think you're right, Brian, that things are getting worse. But I do think we're at an inflection point here where you've had this National Assembly that was elected and is predominantly driven by the opposition, is the only democratic institution in this country. We're approaching the National Assembly elections. And everything that Maduro is doing right now is to try to disenfranchise and undermine the electoral process, to try to eliminate the legitimacy of the National Assembly as this body. What I fear is that during the interregnum, Donald Trump loses in January, is going to be a key time for Venezuela. And that, unfortunately, the debate in the United States over the future of Venezuela policy has become incredibly politicized and polarized, whereas it should be an informed and objective debate about where the United States can most press for democratic outcomes in a way that benefits the Venezuelan people and U.S. national interests.
I mean, in the scheme of things, compared to some other issues, it's not that polarized, right? I mean, everybody wants to see the back of Nicolas Maduro and see democracy in Venezuela. So it's not, you know, it's not as binary as some other areas.
Sure. Yeah. I think where maybe it's too narrow is that today the conversation is who is tougher on Venezuela.
Fair enough.
Right. And an appeal to the South Florida community. But that, and that closes itself off from a much broader discussion of where the United States can actually impact change.
So we've started off talking about Venezuela and Cuba, which I you know, are two very important issues. But I for me, as a Latin Americanist, I always try to gently point out when these conversations happen in the United States that taken together, that's about 3 or 4% of Latin America's population. It's a big region out there. And I want to cover some other topics, including some of the bigger countries while you're here. Let's talk first, though, about another one that has a big intersection point with the United States, which is immigration, and specifically as it regards the Northern Triangle countries of Central America, which so far have not been amongst the hardest hit by COVID, either on the health side or the economic side. But you look at what's happening in so many places, and it seems like a question of time. These are countries that are already under tremendous pressure because of violence, because of economic stagnation, because of climate change. There have been exoduses from those countries, you know, on really on an annual basis. And now there's worries that, given what's happening in Mexico, that there may be a renewed flow of Mexicans north as well. Shannon O'Neill, our friend at Council on Foreign Relations, wrote an op-ed for Bloomberg recently, kind of spelling out that fear. What do you think the main pressure points are going to be? And what do you think the a future Biden administration's stance toward that immigration issue will be?
The things that keep me up at night, Brian, when I think about the election and then post-January, is not just Mexican migration, which you mentioned, Northern Triangle migration, which you could argue because of the COVID-19 restrictions, which have yet to hit Central America and the Caribbean very hard. Once the restrictions are lifted, that there's this pent-up migration that may be coming. But not just that, the political situation and the impact of the pandemic in countries like Haiti and other parts of the Caribbean could produce a mass migration scenario by land and by sea that the Trump administration and the campaign would serve to justify this heavy-handed approach to migration. The other point is migration is one of the toughest issues for Democrats internally. And as somebody who served on the Unity Task Force on Immigration, where we sat down with the Sanders campaign to kind of try to figure out what recommendations to make to the Biden campaign, the biggest difference is there. We're not of objective, but rather how to speak to those issues. And also from a perspective of somebody who served in government, how some of these aspirational ideas may or may not be realistic, or were they at odds with each other.
You're talking about abolish ICE, or are you talking about other stuff too?
Questions like that, and questions of social justice and of dignity and respect for the migrant community, which is something that Biden has said that our immigration policy needs to be a matter of dignity. But on specifics, yeah, how DHS is an organization that was built after the attacks of September 11th, whether they become an overly focused enforcement mechanism that is structured to violate the rights of individuals, or whether they're actually thinking about an immigration system that is one that is supportive to not just our values, but also the needs of this country, is a strong issue of debate. And frankly, as a country, I don't think we've fully defined. But I also think it's a function of the traditional division on immigration between those that are experts on domestic policy, but don't understand the foreign policy implications, and then people like me who are experts on the immigration side south of the border, but don't have this very deep-rooted information for what happens once people get into the immigration court system. But what it comes down to, the main difference, is that Joe Biden thinks that Donald Trump actually is presenting a false choice. And as president, you can, one, enforce the borders. Number one, a wall is not what's going to work. You have to invest in the points of entry, which is where migrants, drugs, and everybody comes in. Invest in those in a way that makes sure that the flow of immigration is managed effectively, to make sure that you're promoting regular migration, but then also promoting commerce. And that fundamentally, and this is something Joe Biden has said, is that when a father or mother has a child who is fleeing violence or is starving, there's no wall large enough to keep somebody like that out. And that we need to invest in making sure that those people want to stay in their country because they have opportunity. I'll tell you an anecdote. when we traveled with the vice president to Guatemala for the first time in June 2014, we were actually traveling to Colombia, we were going to Brazil, we were going to the Dominican Republic. In the air, as we were going on this travel, we got word from the White House that they also wanted us to go to Guatemala and to put together a summit in short order. So Roberta Jacobson and I were on this trip. We were essentially up till 5 a.m. every day on the previous legs of the visit to put together the meeting.
Roberta Jacobson, by the way, was the senior State Department official for Latin America at the time, just for those who don't know.
Correct. And we ended up being able to put together that meeting. The initial approach walking into this meeting was, all right, let's talk about border enforcement to make sure that we're stemming this flow of unaccompanied migrants that at that point were reaching, I think it was over 60,000 to the southwest border. In the course of the conversation, Joe Biden turns back to us on the backbench and says, hey, enforcement isn't going to work here. We actually have to think bigger, and there are resource implications associated with addressing some of the challenges in these countries. And on the fly, he unscripted basically said to the leaders of the Northern Triangle, if you guys develop a plan, work with the IDB, Luis Alberto Moreno was there, develop a plan that is ambitious, and if it's an ambitious plan, Barack Obama and I will stand with you. And that was the genesis of this $750 million strategy. He basically drove it because he fundamentally knew that we could spend billions in border enforcement every year, or we could spend much less in actually addressing the root causes of migration in the long term.
Did it work?
It did. You know, we received the appropriation toward the end of 2016, but the plan itself and the engagement of the vice president at that level led leaders to make decisions that were often against their own political interests. Otto Perez Molina, who was the president of Guatemala, the vice president pressured him into supporting the extension of the Anti-Corruption Commission, CICIG.
Didn't work out so well for OPM, did it?
For him. To this day, he blames Joe Biden for his jailing. But then the Center for Global Development put out this study where they showed that in El Salvador, investments by the United States in reducing violence led to a reduction in migration because people don't want to leave their countries, you know? And so when it comes to any sort of transition around the world, you have to think not just in the short-term bridging actions that provide the political cover you need from, you know, the U.S. Congress and the U.S. taxpayer, but you need to think much longer term into what needs to happen to advance the underlying structural reforms necessary to prevent migration, particularly because in places like Central America, you have what has been a corrupt and predatory elite in most cases that benefits from not investing in social programs in their countries and having migration as a constant source of remittances that drive consumption in these countries. The economic model works for them, and it's something that fundamentally needs to change, and that's not something you can do by flipping a switch.
If there is a phrase that gets overused in foreign policy circles, it's probably Marshall Plan.
Yeah.
Right. But at the same time, you know, if there's a region in the world that would benefit from a large, and it wouldn't even have to be that large in global scheme, infusion of money, it's probably those Northern Triangle countries. 750 million, you know, a couple of years ago, I know that that makes a difference in some of those countries, but at a time like this, with resources being under strain, is it realistic to think of something similar or even bigger going forward? Or do you think it's just, you know, maybe not in the cards right now because of the U.S. Treasury being under so much pressure?
Well, look, the vice president has committed publicly to $4 billion over 4 years. But I mean, to your point, no amount of money is going to make a difference without political commitment on the part of these countries, because that's often what needs to happen. And so I worry more about that.
Yeah, you just can't throw money at these places. It'll just get swallowed up by those elites and entrenched interests that you referenced earlier.
Yeah, and I'm going to say something I'm probably going to get in trouble for, but when the vice president was working on this plan, you know, we didn't like all the leaders that he was working with, but they were democratically elected leaders. But there's a line, right? So Juan Orlando Hernandez in Honduras, you know, we found out during the Trump administration that he is now an unindicted co-conspirator in drug trafficking. You've got to draw the line somewhere. Had we known something like that in the White House, we would have completely put up a lot of distance between the vice president and him. And so when you have the Trump administration praising a Hernandez government, given what his alleged links are, that sends a signal to corrupt individuals in Central America that the administration doesn't care about those sorts of things. So it's a political will function, but Joe Biden is also somebody who the anti-corruption agenda is central to everything he does. And, you know, he stood with U.S. Ambassador Todd Robinson in Guatemala when the government was asking for us to pull him back because he was doing too much on human rights and corruption. And that's the kind of leadership the United States also needs to show in Central America.
So let's switch gears. Juan, you're originally from Colombia. And, you know, Colombia is a country that has made a lot of progress over the last 20 years, a lot of it with U.S. help, Plan Colombia. That story is pretty well known. Of course, most of it was done by the Colombians themselves in terms of both the economic resources and the sacrifices that many brave people made to get that country to where it is today. Today, though, things, I mean, you know, it's a strange environment. It's a country that has been hit hard by COVID. It is a place where, you know, there's a lot of political polarization, dissatisfaction with President Duque. How do you see it, and what do you see engagement between Washington and Bogota looking like in, you know, again, in the event of a Biden victory in November?
Well, I would say I don't think Colombia has a better ally in the United States than Joe Biden, who has actually called it the keystone to the region, you know, and involvement in Plan Colombia, et cetera.
You say involved in Plan Colombia. I mean, this is another one of those moments where you sort of have to take a step back. I mean, he was one of the guys, right? I mean, he was one of the architects that put this thing together.
That's right. He spent 2 days with Andres Pastrana in my native Cartagena. And when he came back, Senate Democrats, some tried to submit an amendment to the legislation trying to cut support for the police and the military. And he gave an extemporaneous floor speech. He was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee at the time and kind of was the guy that sealed the deal on the Senate side. And his argument, which I think continues to be the case, is that U.S. support gives us leverage over Colombia on matters like human rights that is important. But also Colombia, that is at a time when Washington divides itself between people who want to leave Colombia, we've been there too long, those that kind of want to keep going the course, and then people like Joe Biden who see the U.S.-Colombia relationship as one that is ripe to become this broader strategic partnership with regional and global implications. That's why the Obama administration worked with Colombia on Central America. That's why we supported their aspirations to join the OECD and to be play a greater role in NATO, because Colombia is awesome and we want more Colombia around. But Duque is somebody who's facing a series of challenges. Any one of them on their own would be incredibly difficult. But I think the greatest one, as it relates to the fight over the peace process in Colombia, is what is Colombia's political vision for the future now that it doesn't have the FARC to blame for everything? And that sort of vision for the future is much more pluralistic, much more difficult to manage, and requires him to be responsive to a much broader set of the population. And lo and behold, Colombia is not a pluralistic society. And there are people that still fall on some sides of that. They see the peace process as anathema. But look, Uribe as president actually explored peace processes. And at the end of the day, the way that Biden has, from what I've seen, has seen the process in Colombia is one where he has said, okay, this is not something the United States can decide, where the direction of the peace process and how it's implemented and how the balance is reached is really a question for Colombians to decide. And then any concerns or problems or worries that we have, we're not going to put our fingers on the scale by saying these things publicly. We're going to have those conversations in private. And I've seen Biden have some tough conversations with Juan Manuel Santos and with us on the peace process. But you know what? He also respects Colombian institutions and isn't going to, you know, like I said, put his finger on the scale by blasting a leader publicly.
It's interesting that you mentioned polarization and the peace process is kind of the leading issues in Colombia, because there's another one that I know has been front and center under the Trump administration. And I, you know, I understand why. It probably would have been front and center under any administration, which is this spike in coca cultivation and cocaine production that they've had these last couple of years, which, you know, is more than just a Colombia issue. Peru, Bolivia, also huge producers. Drug policy touches Mexico and most countries in the hemisphere, probably. But looking not just at Colombia, but through that frame more broadly, how do you think a Biden administration engages on that issue?
Yeah. So, I mean, first I'll say is when Donald Trump said that Colombia has done nothing for us in relation to the coca issue, as a Colombian American, it's something that kind of hit me to my core, because, Brian, you're as a student of the region, you remember the times when car bombs were going off like crazy in Colombia when Escobar was trying to fight the extradition treaty. You have countless numbers of police and soldiers who've died because of the U.S. demand for cocaine. So I resent that statement on a personal level.
That's true. But I mean, I think what Trump was referring to, in fairness, was President Duque, right? And the fact that these numbers were still At that point, I think the area under cultivation had stopped rising, but it wasn't yet coming down in a meaningful way.
Correct. But I think the focus on the cultivation, it's thinking of Colombia from the perspective of maybe 10 years ago or 5 years ago. I'm also a member of a commissioner on the Western Hemisphere Drug Policy Commission that was part of a congressional legislation to provide recommendations on counter-narcotics policy. And we traveled to Tumaco earlier this year before the pandemic, looking at the restrictions and limitations on coca eradication in Colombia and the move to do it manually now. You look at it and you say, wow, the eradication strategy is not going to succeed, was the conclusion I came away with. I'm not speaking for the commission. And two, you're in communities that are completely cut off from being able to provide alternative products to market. And you start thinking that, all right, this isn't a drug eradication question. It is an economic opportunity question, and one where the United States should be supporting, you know, in addition to eradication, really leaning more on the economic side and also on targeting the higher levels of the value chain through interdiction, through much more complex law enforcement operations, where the money is really made in the coca trade. So measuring Colombia's success on the battle against cocaine by hectares, I think, is no longer the accurate one to be using. That's my personal view.
Well, and President Duque told me when I interviewed him back in, I think it was July 2018, he said that one of his main goals was to desnarcotizar, to denarcotify, not really an English word, but I think everyone will know what I mean, the relationship with the United States, right? So that's kind of the same goal that he's had.
Yeah, and then obviously the drug question is an important one for the bilateral relationship. It is one that requires us to recognize our responsibility in creating that trade. I'm actually working with an interesting group of people called Debrand Cocaine that is trying to do what the Truth campaign did in the United States for cigarettes for cocaine, given just how narcos and all this has romanticized the issue.
I've met them. They're really trying to do some interesting stuff. Basically, they're trying to create a stigma around cocaine specifically, let people know what's in it and how, you know, how many people basically the production kills, and doing it in a way that sort of is appealing to, frankly, to people who might want to use drugs, right? Like, they're not doing it from a Nancy Reagan perspective. They're not trying to appeal to people's puritanical instincts. At least as I understand it, part of the message is, okay, well, you want to do drugs? Well, all right, don't do coke, because here's the human cost of what it does.
Yeah, they're very creative media folks that understand the space. You know, U.S. government people should never be in charge of that sort of media. So interesting stuff that they're doing. But I think that the United States relationship with Colombia is much broader. And I've actually read Duque's Orange Economy book, and I think that the United States' support for the diversification of Colombia away from commodities, making sure that where Colombia can prosper, that can compete with the criminal economy, is in the interest of the United States. So we should be trying to find ways to support those economic aspirations of the Duque administration, while also, of course, calling for progress on the security side, human rights, combating corruption, those sorts of issues that matter to us. So, I mean, Colombia matters for Biden. Colombia will continue to matter. You know, we traveled to the Concordia Summit in 2018 with him, which is where he first met Duque, and he remains very interested in country, and as president will continue to.
So we're nearing the end here. Let's talk about Brazil. And by the way, do I get any credit for some self-discipline and waiting, you know, so long in this conversation to ask about, you know, the country that is not only my main area of interest, but as I never tire of reminding people, you know, 40% of Latin America's GDP and population.
I'm impressed.
It's a country governed by a president, Jair Bolsonaro, who has a great affinity for Donald Trump, you know, who has been called in some respects himself, the, you know, kind of the Trump of the tropics, which I think is an incomplete picture, but often a fair one. He has made no secret of his preference for Trump. His family is kind of in the same boat. His son, a congressman, Eduardo Bolsonaro, once walked out of the Trump Hotel in Washington wearing a Make America Great Again hat. Doesn't get much more partisan than that. The president has started to make some noises recently about, you know, well, we could work with a Biden administration and so on. That, just from the point of view of those of us who are interested in kind of the theatrics of the presidency, that's a fascinating one. It has policy implications too, but what would that personal relationship be like, and what effect do you think it would have on the relationship between the United States and Brazil?
Well, look, I could use this to talk about not just the importance of Brazil, but also North America in the context of what the vice president's announced publicly is, you know, again, I go back to this agenda before us, not just the global pandemic, but the Latin America is facing a whole host of other monumental challenges, demographic changes, dependence on commodity at a time when the world is going through an energy transition, a whole host of issues that are going to have dramatic implications for the region's economic prosperity and security. And I mentioned that by way of introduction to say that as this Build Back Better plan that the vice president has announced envisions a $2 trillion investment in U.S. manufacturing, creating renewable energy economy, like all these things that are, in my view, are not just ones that are meant to create distance between the United States and China, but that the impact will be, this is my personal view, a reorientation of U.S. foreign policy to this hemisphere, starting with North America, where if the United States is to build an auto industry for the 21st century, North America is a part of that picture by default. But also when the vice president talks about his international climate policy to revive climate change efforts internationally, there's no better partner in something like that than a country like Brazil. And that obviously puts him at odds with a climate-denying Bolsonaro administration. So the ball there, Brian, is really, in my view, is in Brazil's court. And the question for Brazil and its political leadership is that they should be looking at the polls here. And that even though there's over 100 days, Joe Biden is going to win this election. And the foreign policy agenda of the United States is one that is going to bring together the most important economies of the world. And he can get on that bus or he can get left behind by that bus. So I think the world is better when you have the United States and Brazil working together on climate change, is trying to find areas of cooperation. Brazil is a leader at the UN. And frankly, even on the issues that matter to Itamaraty, the Brazilian foreign ministry, which isn't always aligned with Brazilians on the street, is when you're thinking about UN Security Council reform over the long term, that's something the United States should be and is committed to, whereas China, Russia, where kind of Itamaraty's affinities, you know, have been since before Bolsonaro, those countries are not interested in UN Security Council reform. So there are clear overlapping interests between U.S. national interests and Brazilian national interests, but it requires Brazilian leadership to make it so.
I know that the Bolsonaro administration has had people sort of try to very politely urge them to make the relationship with the United States rather than just with the Trump administration. That is a phrase that I've heard behind closed doors on many occasions. They have not done much on that front, though, in practice. And what concerns me, I suppose, is that, you know, you have the Bolsonaro government continues to underperform, to use a probably unnecessarily diplomatic term, on the environmental front and where it regards the Amazon in particular. And specifically, they seem to remain convinced in both public and in private that what they have on their hands is a public relations problem rather than a reality problem. Basically, they think that the deforestation in the Amazon, it's not really such a big deal. It's not happening in the level that their own government data conveys, and that the, you know, protectionists in Europe and globalists, which is a bad word to them, kind of the world over, are using the Amazon deforestation as a cudgel to isolate and punish them. And I if they continue with that attitude, you know, that may put them on a collision course with a future Democratic administration that has climate change as a major priority.
Yeah, I think theirs is a short-sighted perspective here. I mean, even among Democrats, it's something we have to keep reminding ourselves that if Joe Biden wins, we're all going to have a default to kind of going to the way things are before the Trump administration. But the world and the United States is not that world anymore. We need to actually be thinking about long-term interests of this hemisphere, of our national interests, of how we find common purpose to address some of these issues of climate change, which are already having an impact in areas like the Caribbean, which are near to dear to the vice president's heart as well. And so, you know, I think Brazil needs to really think much more strategically. Brazil can define its own national interests, but I think there's an opportunity for Brazil to kind of recover the leadership it was developing on the international stage on issues like climate change. And in that, the Brazilian Amazon is central to that. So I don't see it as a messaging issue at all. I see it as a kind of existential issue for the world.
Final question one, Mexico. You know, speaking of kind of the political theatrics, there's been this view in the Mexican press and even amongst sort of foreign policy types, those of us who care about these things here, that, you know, that that visit that President López Obrador made to Washington would be very difficult for a future President Biden to forget, much less forgive. Look, you know, it's hard to know, I suppose, but looking 6 months ahead, I mean, maybe this has something to do with President Biden's personality. How do you think he handles it?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. When you think about it, so Biden is somebody who develops personal relationships with his counterparts, and he's somebody that when he gives his word, I've learned he does not let go, right? Look, when it comes to Mexico, migration is going to be a very, very important issue, number one. But I think that on its face, the calculus, and I think this is perhaps Foreign Minister Ebrard's calculus visiting Washington, was that by ignoring Democrats, he was avoiding upsetting Donald Trump, and that the downside risk of a Democrat winning would be fairly low because Democrats, after all, will behave like adults and not hold a grudge. I think that Biden cares deeply about the U.S.-Mexico relationship. He's chaired the U.S.-Mexico high-level economic dialogue, and he is going to want to have a relationship with Mexico. At what level that relationship is something that he has to think about, whether he wants to engage personally or he wants to delegate it down to a cabinet-level relationship. It'll be something he will have to decide. But I'll tell you, perhaps another reason that AMLO was up here was because he knows that Donald Trump doesn't care about the concerning aspects of AMLO's domestic agenda on weaponizing corruption against opposition, attacking the media, not really respect for contracts. So those sorts of things are concerning and are ones that the United States will raise. And in particular, I think when it comes to the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement implementation, the domestic Build Back Better plan is one that is very much focused on the middle class, on labor. And the context of labor rights inside the USMCA are going to figure prominently in the U.S.-Mexico relationship, given that Democrats fought for it. And maybe that's something that is inconvenient for the current Mexican government.
Juan, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure, Brian, as always.
Thanks for listening to the America's Quarterly Podcast. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave us a review, give us a rating, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The America's Quarterly Podcast is produced by Brendan O'Boyle and Katie Hopkins. America's Quarterly is an independent, not-for-profit publication of America's Society and the Council of the Americas. This has been Brian Winter. Thanks for joining us.